Network Europe, a partnership of the continent's leading international broadcasters. Hello and welcome to this week's programme. I'm Hannah Godfrey. Coming up in today's edition of Network Europe, as Austria hands over the reins of the EU presidency to Finland, we look back over the Austrian legacy and look forward to the challenges facing the Finns. One of Germany's most original and charismatic politicians, Joschka Fischer, is withdrawing from political life. We look back over the career of the man who transformed the German Green Party. As many EU countries experiment with different ways of trying to integrate immigrant populations and also limit the number of people allowed in, Sweden has come up with a controversial proposal that immigrants be required to speak the national language before they're granted citizenship. And we go to Romania to try and find out why so many people there have become shopaholics. Is it just an antidote to the grey years of communism or something more insidious? And the programme will come full circle as this week's Brussels briefing analyses the key issues in the EU presidency handover. So stay tuned. Austria hands over the presidency of the European Union to Finland on Saturday, July the 1st. Over the past 6 months, Austria has had the job of finalising the details of the EU's post-2007 budget, as well as moving the Lisbon strategy forward. This initiative aims to make Europe more competitive and to create more jobs. But an unexpected challenge came Austria's way when Russian energy supplies were suddenly threatened in the depths of the very cold last European winter. Kerry Skyring reports on the highs and lows of the Austrian EU presidency.
Austria conducted what some claimed was a kitsch start to its presidency, a summit called the Sound of Europe. It was held in Salzburg, the birthplace of Mozart, 250 years ago. But even as the cultural clichés were still being rolled out, the first full-blown crisis of the presidency was underway. In the middle of a severe cold snap last winter, Russia began to cut gas supplies to Ukraine, and many European countries connected to the same pipeline were also affected. The EU urged Russia and Ukraine to sort out their dispute, and after gas pressure was restored, Austrian Economy Minister Martin Bartenstein proudly claimed success. But at the end of 6 months, as it hands the European reins over to Finland, has Austria delivered on the key issues of jobs and European competitiveness? Peter Havlik is chief economist at the Vienna Institute for International Economic Studies.
My assessment is that the progress has been rather modest. Of course, there were some successes. There was this agreement on the budget. There was the agreement on the services directive. There were some disputes regarding the liberalization of the labor market. I have in mind changes in these transitory periods regarding the new EU member states.
Modest progress, perhaps, but then the Austrian presidency did manage to escape the major crises of the previous two. The crisis over the constitutional treaty, rejected by France and the Netherlands, and the budget crisis, finally resolved by Britain. But is a crisis-free presidency necessarily a successful one? According to Johannes Pollack, EU expert at the Austrian Academy of Sciences, the answer is no. He says there's still much to be done.
And what is very important is, for instance, the adoption of the seventh framework program for research and science, something which has not happened during the Austrian presidency. Then there should be, I think, there should be a discussion also about the employment policy or Lisbon strategy, which was not paid a lot of attention to in the last years and in the last months.
Despite Austria saying that that is a priority.
If you look at the figures of the financial agreement, you definitely see that this is very much hot air and has nothing to do with the substance or the money which is really devoted to these issues.
That's as much a criticism of other EU nations as it is of Austria. Even Germany wanted a tight cap on European spending. But there was praise from many for the way Austria kept alive the discussion over Europe's future and the constitution. Here's how one outside observer summed it up. Andrew Moravchik is director of the European Union program at Princeton University in the United States.
I think the Austrian presidency's rhetoric has been very positive. That rhetoric has stressed simultaneously the unity of Europe and the diversity of its peoples, policies, and political systems. It's that balance between unity and diversity that is the distinctive contribution of Europe in the modern period.
So, as the land of Mozart and Freud hands the reins to the land of reindeer and Nokia, no major crises are on the horizon. The debate over what to do about the EU's lapsed constitution has been put off until the German presidency in the second half of 2007. Austria's centre-right government has unashamedly declared the EU presidency a success. It certainly ended on a high note with a visit last week of US President George W. Bush for a transatlantic summit. The government is hoping that all of this will add up to good marks from the voters. There'll be an election in Austria within months of the presidency ending. Kerry Skyring, Deutsche Welle Radio, Vienna.
Finland is about to begin its second EU presidency. The first was back in 1999. Since that time, the union has grown, and the challenges facing it today have changed. I asked Finland-based journalist Cheryl Riggins what will be the principal meetings of the Finnish presidency.
Well, in addition, of course, to some 130 official and unofficial meetings at varying levels, there will be three major meetings. There will be an unofficial meeting of EU heads of government, and that will be in October, and the Russian President Vladimir Putin has been invited to attend. The Asia-Europe summit is an important meeting. And then the third important meeting will be the foreign minister's follow-up meeting of what is called the Barcelona process. It's called Euromed.
And what's the Finnish agenda for the presidency?
Well, in outlining his agenda to the parliament, Prime Minister Matti Vanhanen mentioned several issues of priority. And the first one is the constitutional treaty. As we know, the EU leaders decided at their recent Brussels summit on a period of reflection, which comes after the French and Dutch electorates rejected the treaty. Mr. Vanhanen, the Finnish Prime Minister, wants a two-track approach. He wants to improve the way the union functions under existing treaties, but at the same time, he wants to start discussion of how to proceed with the constitutional treaty. There are no substantive decisions that will be made on this issue, of course, until after the French elections next spring. And Finland is expected to ratify the treaty sometime during its presidency. That will be ratified by Parliament.
And what about enlargement?
Yes, enlargement is a priority issue. Bulgaria and Romania are expected to become members in probably January of 2007, so that will be approved on Finland's watch. Also, talks have begun for very initial talks on membership for Turkey and Croatia, so those are important. And on this subject, decision-making institutions and processes need reform, and Mr. Vanhanen hopes that a new consensus can be formed on enlargement. He feels that this is an important area, and he has mentioned that Turkey and Croatia will get attention under Finland's presidency.
And are any other issues likely to come up during the Finnish presidency?
Yes, there are many, of course, but one area that is an area of priority and very important for the Finnish presidency is the question of external EU relations. This is of particular importance to Finland with the emphasis on EU-Russia relations. Mr. Vanhanen wants these relations to be clarified because of the uncertain situation in Russia today. Particularly here, he stresses energy policy as one example. Now, the Russian President Vladimir Putin will attend the informal meeting of heads of government where these relations can be discussed, and Vanhanen has stressed energy will be important. There will be a head start to discussing this subject at this month's G8 summit in St. Petersburg, which Mr. Putin will host, and Putin has made energy a major theme of this summit. Mr. Vanhanen also wants to strengthen the EU's international role, and he wants more integration of civil and military crisis management. And another area of importance or areas for the Finnish presidency is the areas of transparency and efficiency. When the Finnish Prime Minister Matti Vanhanen presented Finland's agenda to Parliament, he stressed that he feels that there are two very serious problems the EU must deal with. It is the two inefficient methods of decision-making, and also he feels the lack of legitimacy in the eyes of EU citizens is just something that must be addressed. He feels greater transparency is absolutely vital to help the EU and Brussels win legitimacy.
That was Cheryl Riggins. One of Germany's most colourful politicians, former Foreign Minister Joschka Fischer, is pulling the plug on his electrifying political career. The charismatic leader of the Green Party has spent more than two decades in German politics and led his party from an ecologist fringe grouping to a respected government party, and has left their stamp on sweeping social, energy and foreign policy changes. Joschka Fischer starts an academic career at an American university, leaving behind shoes too large to fill by his political successors, as Uwe Hessler reports from Berlin.
After more than two decades in German politics, the show is over now for a man who reinvented himself a dozen times on a journey from stone-throwing revolutionary to necktie-clad minister. For many years, Joschka Fischer was Germany's most popular politician, and the public was fascinated by his life, his four broken marriages, and his tendency to rapidly lose weight, gain it back, and then lose it again. The political career of the charismatic figurehead of the Greens Party began in the anarchist circles in the town of Frankfurt in the early 1980s. He first shot to nationwide prominence for wearing sneakers and jeans when being sworn in as Environment Minister of the state of Hesse in 1985. He has remained true to himself, says Rupert von Plotnitz, one of Fischer's longtime political companion.
He has stuck to his ideals in a sense that he has never evaded a good fight with his political rivals. However, he was also able to change his mind when realizing that he was wrong, and he was as convincing in defending his new position.
In 1998, Fischer led his Greens party as junior partners into the coalition government, starting a seven-year era that has changed the face of the nation. In 1999, Joschka Fischer completed his political masterpiece by rallying his strongly pacifist Greens behind plans for Germany to participate in the Kosovo War, this country's first combat mission since World War II.
Was würde es denn heißen unter dem Gesichtspunkt Wahrung des Friedens?
What will it mean for preserving peace there if the international community doesn't step up the pressure now? We'll have a full-blown war and a human catastrophe right at our doorstep. The Milosevic government constitutes a permanent threat to peace in Europe, which we can never accept.
As German Foreign Minister, Joschka Fischer was praised for his role as an honest broker in the Middle East conflict. The Red-Green government, however, failed to come to grips with Germany's economic woes, and so Joschka Fischer's popularity waned in the final stages of the Schröder government. Nevertheless, former Interior Minister Otto Schily says he looks back at seven good years with Joschka Fischer, and adds that Fischer's demise reflects his knack for popular politics.
I find it very respectable how he's taken his leave. It's a demise in dignity and self-respect. His remarks that with him the last live rock and roller in Germany was leaving the stage and that now the lip-syncing generation took over betrays his huge self-confidence.
As of September, Joschka Fischer will join Princeton University's teaching staff for a year-long appointment. He will co-teach the undergraduate course on international crisis diplomacy. He says this is an excellent opportunity to start new projects in life. Uwe Hessler, Deutsche Welle Radio, Berlin.
Sweden has entered its annual summer break, but this year's holidays coincide with the last intense months of campaigning before the country's national elections in September. One reoccurring issue in the debate this year is the perceived failure of the present government to integrate immigrants into Swedish society. Now the opposition Liberal Party has resurrected a controversial set of proposals, which was given credit for winning the party votes last election, but also gained unwanted support from anti-immigrant elements in Swedish society. The proposal, a demand that people be able to speak Swedish before they're granted citizenship. Radio Sweden's Bill Schiller reports.
Many in Sweden have blasted what they call insufficient efforts by the minority social democratic government to integrate immigrants and refugees into society, and especially into the labor market. Some observers blame this lack of integration for the growth of anti-immigrant attitudes here, and some of these right-wing groups have already gained seats in local politics and are now aiming at the parliament itself. Some of the sharp criticism over integration has also come from the four parties of the Non-Socialist Alliance, hoping to gain power in September: the moderate conservatives, the center, the Christian Democrats, and the Liberal Party. A few years ago, the Liberals came out with a controversial language demand on the foreign-born seeking Swedish citizenship, with some critics saying this for Sweden hardline policies play into the hands of the anti-immigrant forces, wanting to crack down or even expel the foreign-born. But the Liberals reject this, claiming that it's in line with policies of other European nations. But they admit that not all the members of the Swedish alliance are in agreement. Liberal Party leader Lars Leijonborg.
Well, I hope that the opposition will not be so serious on this. We have very, very good arguments for our proposals. My hope is that the alliance can unite about this.
Earlier, some jubilation from anti-immigrant forces saying this is the right way, be hard on the immigrants, and the Folk Party is the only one getting tougher. Afraid this might happen again?
I can't understand that argument at all. We have a lot of proposals making it easier for foreigners coming to Sweden. We are very, very much in favor of a very humane asylum policy. So it's ridiculous to say that the Swedish Liberals will be anti-immigration.
And the demands on an immigrant, a refugee, language-wise, before becoming a citizen, is this really necessary? Aren't most of those who do apply for citizenship already speaking Swedish to some degree?
Yes, to some degree, and some of them, of course, speak Swedish very well. But we think that it will increase the motivation to learn Swedish, and it's a correct signal from the official Sweden to immigrants that if you intend to live the rest of your life in Sweden, it's very, very wise to learn reasonable Swedish.
Are the other parties in your coalition in favor of this too, or is there a division of opinion?
In this issue, we are united. All of us believe that it's correct that in Sweden, Swedish should be the official majority language.
The Swedish Liberal Party spokesman on integration policy, Mauricio Rojas.
Well, the Liberal Party will create integration. And integration presupposes jobs, but even that you speak the language of the country. Today we have very few forces driving the immigrants to learn Swedish. And we say, if for getting the Swedish citizenship, we have to prove in some way that you are able to speak Swedish, that will be a very strong force, a very strong signal to the immigrants, learn Swedish.
The Liberal Party is hoping to take over government power together with your three allies on the non-socialist side. What do they say about such ideas?
Well, the Conservative Party, the moderates, are for this demand. The other two has been against, but we think that we are going to be able to convince them. All the countries in Europe are moving towards this kind of demands. All the Nordic countries are today putting this demand, as Norway or Denmark and Finland. So I think that the other parties in the alliance will be sooner or later able to help us to put this demand on.
The remaining days of the campaigning will reveal just how controversial Liberal Party suggestions are about language demands for Swedish citizenship, more funding for Swedish courses for immigrants, and making Swedish the national language on paper as well as in reality.
You're listening to Network Europe. And now we go to Romania, where the number of supermarkets and shopping malls is booming. And so is the number of shopaholics. After living in deprivation for so long, especially in the 1980s, the last years of communist dictatorship, Romanians finally began to enjoy what Westerners had already been experiencing for decades: supermarkets and shopping malls. Shop Till You Drop seems to be one of Romanians' favourite ways of spending their free time. Radio Romania International's Christina Tiberian has more.
We used to build civilizations, now we build shopping malls. This is what American writer Bill Bryson was saying about the United States in 1991, at a time when Romania was just beginning to stretch its legs after being buried under 50 years of communism. But of course it wasn't long until the country started building its own shopping malls. All of a sudden, shopping acquired an entirely different meaning, says Sherban Angelescu, an anthropologist with the Romanian Peasant Museum in Bucharest.
There were all sorts of norms that used to regulate consumption in communist Romania. You couldn't just go out and buy whatever you wanted, whenever you wanted it. And you certainly couldn't find everything in these miniature universes that are today's supermarkets and shopping malls. Today, you don't have to get up at 4 a.m. to buy milk, and you don't have to wait for Christmas to find green bananas in the shop. So many of the criteria that regulated consumption disappeared, and 16 years after the end of the communist era, we're still in a shopping frenzy.
There are now 5 shopping malls in Bucharest, but by 2008, their number will triple. The shopping mall in Romania is more than just a place where you can shop. It's where you go to the cinema for that magical Dolby surround, and of course for the popcorn and the Cokes. It's where you go to eat in fast foods, and for many, it's where you go to parade yourself. You put on your best clothes and walk those aisles and look good. If you go to one of these malls at the weekend, you have to brace yourself to face the crowds of compulsive shoppers, carrying several bags in their hands and waiting for yet another bag at the end of the line at the cash desk. Turkish retail development manager Ali Ergun Ergen is the man behind 2 of Bucharest's most popular shopping malls. He's now planning to open a 3rd mall, which he says will be the biggest in the country. He believes Romania's consumer frenzy is normal.
The retail market has just started developing very recently. The presence of international retailers, the presence of fashion, food, was not that varied before. And basically there was no competition, there was no offer on the market. That's one of the key reasons why people are very, very addicted to consuming today. And the other reason is probably people like to follow fashion here. People like to dress nice clothes, like to buy new things. I think it's an eventual consequence of the market, an emerging market. People have more money to spend. People are traveling today and they're watching TV, they're watching fashion shows, they're following the new trends.
Communism is often a scapegoat for many of Romanians' habits and foibles. And yes, the fact that Romania is a society emerging from almost half a century of communist dictatorship does explain the popularity of shopping malls and supermarkets. But how long can we still afford to seek excuses in communism? After all, there's nothing wrong with following the new trends, keeping up with the times. It's the way forward. It's not like we're mistaking the means to support life for life itself. Or is it? Has Descartes' I think, therefore I am been turned into I shop, therefore I am? There's some good food for thought for when you're absent-mindedly walking the aisles of a supermarket. From Bucharest, this is Cristina Tiberian, Radio Romania International.
And now we go over to Brussels, from where Stephen Castle gives us this week's report.
For most of the EU's 450 million citizens, July the 1st won't stand out as a particularly important date. But for officials in the EU, it marks a significant juncture. The end of the current EU presidency, held by Austria, as it hands the baton on to Finland. Taking over the rotating presidency of the EU means chairing all key committees, including EU leaders' summits, and controlling the policy agenda. Diplomats have long complained about these 6-monthly changes of leadership, saying they rob the EU of continuity. In fact, the European Constitution planned to scrap the system. But with the Constitution on ice, the 6-month presidency remains intact. And for the member states, particularly small ones, it provides a chance to strut on the international stage. Austria seems to have enjoyed its presidency. For its logo, it adopted a bright and stylish multicoloured barcode designed by the Dutch artist Rem Koolhaas and incorporating the flags of all EU member states. It held a weekend seminar on European culture in Salzburg, calling it the Sound of Europe. And on the eve of a summit in Vienna, it staged a 6-a-side football match for leaders. It may not be the biggest achievement in EU history, but the Austrians have improved the atmosphere. In December last year, the British presidency clinched a deal on EU financing for the period 2007 to 2013, but only after a rancorous negotiation. The EU member states are divided about the fate of their stalled constitution. They're split over the future of enlargement and on their approach to Turkey's bid for EU membership. And there is a power vacuum, with political leaders in France, Italy, Poland and the UK all facing domestic difficulties. Sensibly, the Austrian Chancellor Wolfgang Schüssel opted to lower his ambitions and concentrate on keeping the show on the road. During the Austrian presidency, there were one or two important deals, including a watered-down agreement on a directive to open up the EU's lucrative market in services. But the main accomplishment of the presidency was to avert another crisis. Knowing that no agreement is possible at the moment on the Constitution, Mr. Schüssel opted for the less ambitious task of laying down a timetable to decide its fate. That ought to be done by the end of 2008. Despite Austria's own ambivalence towards Turkish membership of the EU, the presidency started detailed negotiations with Ankara. It also averted a full-blown crisis over Turkey's approach to the divided Mediterranean island of Cyprus. But there were criticisms too. EU officials complained that the Austrians referred too many decisions back to Vienna rather than delegating to their staff in Brussels. And as they start planning for a summer on Europe's beaches, diplomats know that the key problems have been delayed rather than solved. Tensions remain over the constitution and how to deal with the legacy of those referendum no votes last year in France and the Netherlands. A full-grown crisis looms in the autumn over EU enlargement. Negotiations with Turkey are likely to be suspended unless Ankara opens up its ports to Cypriot ships, something the Turkish government is loath to do. And it remains far from clear that the EU is more popular with its citizens than it was when the Austrians took over in January. Nevertheless, for the time being, the system of rotating EU presidencies remains alive and kicking. Some of the countries that joined the EU 2 years ago will soon start taking the helm, the first being Slovenia in 2008. And with 25 nations now in the club, Austria will have to wait some time before its next turn in the hot seat, even assuming the system of rotating presidencies survives. The next Austrian presidency is scheduled for the year 2019. This is Stephen Castle in Brussels.
And that brings us to the end of this week's Network Europe. Don't forget to look at our new website, www.networkeurope.org, where you can listen to this week's edition again if there was anything you missed. I'm Hannah Godfrey, and I'd like to thank you for listening to the programme. I'll leave you with David Bowie's song, I Would Be Your Slave, from his 2002 album, Heathen.
Sleeping quiet until